Hello, everybody. This is Dr. Diana Wiley. I am your host of Love, Lust, and Laughter. Well, in 2 days, we have Thanksgiving. And for some, sex has become, less like the 4th of July and more like Thanksgiving. So to help us keep the fireworks going, we have, again, Veronica Monet. She's returning for part two this week. She's a relationship coach, and her exquisite partnership formula targets two taboo emotions, and that would be sexual desire and anger. Veronica was not always a relationship coach. Now, here's the provocative part, listeners. From 1989 to 2004, she was a high-end escort who catered to wealthy businessmen. And during her 14-year career as a sex professional, Veronica was interviewed for hundreds of major media outlets, including CNN, Fox News, and the New York Times. So then she transitioned from escorting to coaching, and she wrote a book, Sex Secrets of Escorts, and it was published in 2005 and translated into many different languages. Her publisher was Penguin Books, and they really wanted her to write a sex manual, so she did that. But what she really wanted to share with her readers was what she learned about men while escorting. So Veronica is going to treat us. She's going to tell us what she was not allowed to write about in her book. Hello again, Veronica. It's so nice to have you back on the program.
Oh, thank you, Diana. I'm glad to be here. Just really excited, actually. It's so much fun to hang out with you.
Oh, well, thank you. And you too. You too. And I thought last week's show, and if any of you have not heard last week's show, it is archived, so go look for it. So I think the first question we'll ask you is, what did you learn about men while working as an escort?
Well, you know, I was really surprised what I learned. I really was I was a college graduate who had 7 years in corporate America. And what I knew about employment was that you get a job description, you fulfill those duties, and somebody gives you a paycheck. That's how life works.
Mm-hmm.
And when I decided to become an escort, I just kind of assumed that the men who paid me for sex were going to kind of be my employer, and I would be taking instructions from them. And nothing could have been further from the truth.
Mm-hmm.
What I discovered was actually they, you know, maybe it has something to do with the level that I was working at. I never started off at a low level sex worker position, and I don't mean that disparagingly towards any of the different occupations that there are in the sex industry. I have respect for all of them.
But yes, of course.
Just like in any industry, you can kind of work your way up. And I kind of started in the mid-range. So I was already at the very, very beginning as a college graduate working with, doctors and lawyers, which.
Right. And also, by the way, and you can see her picture from last week, you're a beautiful woman. And that helps a lot. And plus, you're fit. I mean, you lift weights, you do yoga. So that beauty and brains must have been very alluring for a lot of your clients.
You know, it's interesting. I recently read what constitutes, which escorts are the most successful. And I was really surprised to find out that I fit the description perfectly. It was basically a petite, athletic, college-educated woman in her late 20s, early 30s. And that's I was 29 when I started. I had a college degree, and I was totally, and I still am. I've been to weightlifting my whole life, basically.
Yeah.
So, what I just was shocked that these men actually wanted to give all their control to me. And I'm not talking about BDSM, although eventually I did get into that as a pro dom. I would just, they just wanted, here's some money. Now you tell me what we're going to do. And I'm like, what? What is this about? So I ended up having to take classes in sexuality so that I had some repertoire, so that I had something to teach, to share, to something to kind of, you know, offer. And I had no idea that this was a profession that would actually require further education after my college degree. So, but I invested in it. I learned Tantra and sacred prostitution classes. I really got into it.
Good.
Yeah, and I found that, contrary to the guys that I dated when I was in college, the men that I saw professionally were polite, they were respectful. My God, I just, it was so flying in the face of everything I'd been taught about men who would see prostitutes. And, you know, obviously I had my own unique set of experiences, but they weren't that unique. I ended up becoming a sex worker rights activist, and I've met hundreds of other sex workers who had the same experience of adoring fans, really. Clients who are basically adoring fans who flower them with gifts and treat them like queens. So, That was an unexpected side benefit to the job. And the other thing that I found, which really also amazed me, was that the men who were paying for my time were really wanting to feel like they were special. They wanted to have some kind of an intimate connection with me. And my initial thoughts were, I'm kind of a task-oriented, logical gal, and I was just like, okay, you know, we've contracted for an hour, you paid me this much, and so, you know, I'm going to perform thus and thus services, and then we're done. And it was like, no, that also was not what they wanted. They wanted something that, well, a lot of people refer to as GFE, the girlfriend experience. And wow, if only the guys in college had wanted the girlfriend experience. You know, if they had wanted to cuddle and engage in pillow talk and get to know me. But it seemed like the guys in college just couldn't wait to stick it in you, you know, and then and then hopefully move on to the next girl. So I found clients to be completely different. They'd get attached. They'd see you for years. I had clients that stayed with me the entire time I was working, which was 14 years.
Yes. They became attached to you, probably fell in love with you.
Yes, there was a lot of that. And it wound up being a far more human and humane job than I ever experienced when I was working in corporate America. It was much more heart-centered than and I felt a lot more respected. And there was another thing that happened for me. I basically had a huge dislike for men when I started in 1989. I had hit the glass ceiling repeatedly and was sick to death of male-dominated workplace. And so I was kind of like, well, I'm just going to go work for myself. And since most of the men in the companies I worked at seemed to always be trying to have sex with me, if that's all they want, fine. That's what I'll do, and I'll get paid handsomely for it, too.
Right.
But what I found was that these men were much more interested in a personal, emotional connection. And I got to see their vulnerabilities that I had never been exposed to before. And you know, it turned out to be a lot like a counseling job. I was doing a lot of counseling. It's like a lot of therapy takes place between a provider and her client. And you know, I've held a lot of men while they were crying. I've helped men work past deaths in the family, divorce, bankruptcy, and then move on to become huge successes, start their own companies. It's just really amazing to be kind of somebody's mentor and muse as they go through all these different stages of their life. And I had one client who also came to me because he was dying. And to really help that person feel like a man again, to feel really connected to his sexuality and his body, and to feel appreciated and loved before he died, it was a huge honor and gift to me.
I can understand that. So to back up what you're saying with, I've read a number of studies that have to do with what we're with our topic today, but the one that applies to this, to your comments, is a Kinsey Institute. They did an international survey of more than 1,000 middle-aged couples who had, on average, been together 25 years. So the researchers measured each partner's relationship and sexual satisfaction on a number of variables, and some of the findings were obvious. You know, sexual functioning, for instance, was strongly related to male sexual satisfaction. But other findings in this study were highly unexpected. And one striking finding, and striking is the term that that the report used, they found a strong connection between a man's relationship satisfaction and his frequency of physical intimacy, but not physical intimacy as in sex, but physical intimacy as in kissing, cuddling, and in general, not necessarily sexual, caressing. So the odds of a man being happy in his relationship increased by a factor of 3 if he snuggled up regularly. And so that reflects some of your experiences with these guys.
Well, yes. And I had clients that I kind of had to coach them into that. They might be really penis centric and looking for a quick release. And so to slow them down and help them achieve a peak sexual experience, you know, sometimes required some coaching to help them get to there, because that wasn't their first impulse. But I learned a lot from my clients, because they were bringing to me a side to men that I had not been exposed to before, which was much more vulnerable. And really, you know, at the end of those 14 years, people ask me, well, what'd you learn about men? And I say this, you know, with a big smile on my face, is that they're girls. In other words, that a lot of the gender differences that we delineate are the result of circumstance. And if you change the dynamics and the circumstances, then the person will change their behavior. So if the game is that you have to win me over in order to have sex with me, you're probably going to have kind of a goal-oriented orientation towards sex. And you're going to be looking for ways to maybe outmaneuver me, outsmart me, to coerce me, convince me, entice me. And it's going to feel a little bit like a game or a trick. But if you shift that dynamic to, sure, you're going to have sex, all you got to do is pay for it, all of a sudden then the man becomes like, oh, yeah, but that doesn't mean I'm special.
Yes.
I need to feel special. How do I feel special? So, and then you all of a sudden realize everybody, whether they're a man or a woman, wants to feel special. And feeling special is actually more important to people than getting laid.
Right. And so that's based in one's a sense of self and self-confidence and self-esteem to feel special.
Yes.
And probably these men were maybe many of them were married to women who had stopped appreciating their husbands.
You know, that's such a common myth. Yeah, I mean, sure, there were those guys whose wives had stopped having sex with them altogether, or were having, you know, uninspired sex with them. But there was also guys who had models for wives and wives who were totally into, you know, having three ways and going to sex parties, and still. So no, I think that one myth that probably really does hold true is the lonely businessman.
Yes.
I saw so much of that. Guys who are traveling and are not at home, and either they don't have a relationship or they are never home to connect with that relationship. Mm-hmm. And they live their lives in hotel rooms and airplanes. And it's it's sad to me, because most of these men are really trying to make a quote unquote success of themselves financially. As I worked my way up over those 14 years, I wound up seeing people that were, I started off thinking that doctors and lawyers were wealthy, and I found out they were poor.
Really? Say more about that.
Well, the clients that I catered to towards the end of my career, the last 5 years of my career, were, you know, people who maybe owned five major U.S. corporations, multimillionaires and billionaires. So that's just way beyond what most doctors and lawyers are.
Well, that's true. Yes.
Yeah. So, you know, people who wind up in Forbes magazine.
Right.
So I just found that those guys, a lot of them too, because they are so uber successful financially, can survive on like 4 hours of sleep a night. But their bodies take a toll. All of that, you know, hotel food and airplane travel and short, you know, just hardly getting any sleep. And not really having a lot of substantial human connection, it takes a toll on their bodies. And it was really sad to me to kind of see, here's the successful man, the guy who's worth hundreds of millions of dollars or billions of dollars, who basically has sacrificed so much that makes life as a human being meaningful. He's lost time with his children, lost time with his wife, isn't really taking good care of his body, and is subjected to high levels of stress. I just thought, wow. And so all that money is going to wind up going to their heirs and their wives. And a lot of them look like they were headed for an early grave, you know, just because of poor, very, very poor health. So that was the other thing that happened for me, is I got a huge sense of compassion, actually, for the 1%. Working with those people,
yes.
I started to realize that their lives were not as glamorous as we might think. And I realized I was no longer envious. I actually felt sorry for them.
So there was a recent study that showed that having regular sex and once a week for this study was determined as optimal, created more happiness than, say, a $50,000 raise. That having regular sex that was connected, that was good, and of course we know that having orgasms and being sort of in this oxytocin float is so good for us. It's so good for stress. It's so good. It's just amazing. But yes, that and I have known personally some very wealthy people, and a lot of them are not that happy. And of course, some of them have been clients, but also on a personal level. So a lot just aren't happy. They're working all the time. So for a successful wealthy businessman to have time with you where you didn't demand anything of him, where you could be sexual and enjoying him and sensual and complimenting him.
Let's clarify what kind of an escort I was, because you're describing somebody else there instead of me.
Okay, Veronica. I want you to tell it as it was.
I started off in the 1989, so by like 91, I guess we start mm-hmm. having an internet. Mm-hmm. And I'm one of the very first escorts to actually go on the internet. And before it was the internet, we had something called a BBS, where you had to like log in. Mm-hmm. And I would post short video clips of myself, pornographic video clips, and naked pictures of myself on this BBS. And people would get a newspaper, they'd see an ad where it was just a black and white photo of me, which is all anybody had. And they'd call me up and I'd say, well, you can go to this thing on the internet if you can log in, if you have a computer.
Yes.
Long ago. If you have a computer, you can log in and you can look at some color photos and a couple of short video clips. So from there, the internet very quickly took off, of course, and I was on one of the very first escorting websites, and I immediately started running articles because I have been a writer my whole life. That's who I am.
It's clear from your newsletter. You are an excellent writer. Yes.
Thank you. So
you're welcome.
I wrote about the things that matter to me. I wrote about feminism. I wrote about LGBTQ. I was very defiant, an angry young woman who was speaking her mind politically. And I had a lot of colleagues tell me, you're going to lose business doing that. These men mm-hmm. don't want to know about your feminist viewpoints. That's a big turnoff. And I thought, well, then I don't want to see them. I don't care.
Good.
Good. For me,
you had your standards.
speaking my truth was the most important thing.
Yeah.
And I found that it actually worked really well. I got more clients who paid more money. And it was ironic to me because my colleagues were so afraid to tell the truth about what they felt and who they were, and afraid to disagree with their wealthy clients. And I made a profession out of disagreeing and arguing with my wealthy clients. And I'll tell you, I hit this place one day. I was on an island resort in the state of Washington with one of my high-end clients, and we had flown into this, and I always insisted on having my own private suite. And this particular trip did not involve any sex whatsoever. And that I have clients that I never had sex with.
They wanted you as a confidant, to have a conversation with you because they no doubt respected that you would tell your truth.
Yes. That's what this client that I had known for many years was sitting across from me. We're both got newspaper and coffee cups, you know, if you can picture that. And he looks at me and he says, your rates are too high. Your personality is too difficult. And then he got a tear, his tears started to well up in his eyes. But he said, I need at least one person in my life who will disagree with me.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. And that was the other thing that I learned about, you know, people are complex. People are complex. And I thought, so this is where I got some of my compassion for the 1%. It was like, nobody's going to tell him what they actually think. They don't want to get cut out of the will. They don't want to not benefit from his money. They're all just kissing his butt.
Sure.
So my whole thing was, no, I'm sorry, I don't. I tell it like it is. And those were the people who, they saw me on television, and they wanted that person. They wanted that person who was going to be honest with them. And mm-hmm. that helped me have respect for men in ways that I didn't before, too. Mm-hmm. You know, I started realizing that if a man is very accomplished and very powerful, what he really, really wants is somebody who can hold her own with him.
I suspect that there's a lot of truth to that. They don't want a clingy, needy woman who it just says yes all the time.
No, that's for insecure men.
Right, right.
Insecure men who are aspiring and try to prove, you know, they're not confident, and so then that's what they're looking for.
So what do you think, so with these 1% men, so what were some of their motivations for wanting to see you other than to have a decent conversation and to not and to have somebody who would disagree with them? So what were some of their other motivations?
Well, I think it's really about the total package, right? They mm-hmm. you know, even, you know, I was on a $50,000 contract with one client who never had sex with me. Mm-hmm. But by and large, most people did want to have that as a possibility, as a feature.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, the titillation, the sense of that's at least a possibility that it might happen, certainly adds excitement to the encounter.
Mm-hmm.
I think, you know, having a conversation with someone, that kind of reduces it down to something that maybe isn't really all that accurate. It's really about an intellectual connection that mm-hmm. feeds the mind and the soul and the heart. And it's, again, we come back to this ancient sacred prostitution mm-hmm. Concept that we don't really have much connection with in our modern day culture. But I studied that, and that was very much about, I think, supporting your client in being the best that they can be. So you think of yourself in a more of a therapeutic role. How do you encourage? How do you help them aspire? I remember one client who was coming to see me, and this was before I started seeing the 1%. So he was working for somebody else in a high-level job, but he was still working for somebody else. And he just couldn't stand his job. And so every time we got together, there was the sexual connection for sure. And I kind of think for some men, the sex actually helps them connect more with their heart and with their thoughts. You know, they are more able to kind of contact their feelings.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So there would be like this vulnerability after the sex in which they would talk about how they were really feeling. And because I am the way I am, I always showed up, you know, to kind of be their therapist.
Mm-hmm.
And I watched this guy go from, you know, being very, very frustrated with his employer to wondering if he was ever going to be able to ask him for a raise. But then he just started his own company and became successful. And it was such a thrill to watch that and to know that I had made some contribution towards helping him feel good about himself so that he could go do that. But, there's something...
Mm-hmm.
Well, I don't want to leave the women out here because there's
right.
you know, almost all
right.
these men had women in their lives, and I think it's really important to talk about women.
Agree.
And I noticed that some of the fears that women have about what their husbands or boyfriends might be thinking weren't warranted. I very rarely heard men complain about their partners. The complaint, the most typical complaint was, I wish she loved her body as much as I do, and I wish that she would let me touch her more.
Mm-hmm.
So there was just like this sense of wanting to have more connection with the women in their lives, and that was that was refreshing too. Again, I was like, well, that was really against my stereotypes of what I thought. Oh, these guys probably, you know, don't appreciate their wives and girlfriends, and they're always looking for something better. And I'm sure that exists. I have mm-hmm. no doubt it exists. But it just wasn't my experience. I met lots and lots of guys who were just really missing their wives and girlfriends and wishing for more of a connection.
And, well, I know that a lot of women have body image problems. I mean, I see them in my practice, and it's very hard to be an uninhibited, fun sexual partner where the whole body is a playground and not just the genitals, right? If you have all these negative feelings about your body, you have to come to terms with your body, even your less than perfect body, and feel good about it. And so that's probably some of what was reflected in some of your clients' suggestions that their partners just didn't love their bodies enough, and that the man would love having more touching.
It's not women's fault that they feel that way. I mean, we are just inundated with so much programming.
That's true.
I feel that it's almost a conspiracy, frankly, against womankind to try to dismantle us so that we can't become any kind of a political or economic threat to the system. We're just so worried about our thighs or the bags under our eyes that, you know, we can't mm-hmm. function. Mm-hmm. It's a travesty. What is done to women, and young girls start worrying about their bodies as soon as they hit puberty, if not before.
So, I mean, I read a study some years ago, because I've worked a little bit over the years with eating disorders, and in this one study, girls as young as 9 were starting their first diets, and usually they had mothers who were very concerned with their own body image, and maybe the daughter would go along with the mother to the Weight Watchers meeting. You know, so
yeah.
all of these influences, yeah.
I remember being at the, you know, I've been hanging out at the gym for a few decades, and I remember being at this one gym, and I watched this woman get on the scales, and, you know, beautiful woman, had a lovely body. She hops on the scales. She looks at what it says, and she gets this really disgusted look on her face and kind of stomps off the scales. And here comes her little daughter, who couldn't have been more than 8 years old, hops on the scale right after mommy, weighs herself, gets this big frown on her face, and stomps off the scales.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought, oh, man. It's almost a rite of passage, you know, a way of identifying with other females, that we're all going to sit around and talk, you know, bad about ourselves.
Mm-hmm.
And I think I've seen a lot of healthy trends where, and I particularly look to Black women who are really just shaking things up around body image. And for me, I don't see a lot of white women that are leading the way on that in a way that really makes me feel empowered. But I just watched a YouTube video last night on Facebook, and this woman was doing a poetry slam, I think you call it. And her title of it was, "The Body is Not an Apology."
good.
Yeah. Very
good.
Inspiring. Very inspiring. So, you know, the thing that when I wrote my book, Sex Secrets of Escorts, one of the things that I was trying to do is encourage women to step into a place of being fully empowered around their sexuality. So to not wait for a man to seduce them, but rather to, you know, have some input in what's going on sexually if they're relating to a man. how I remember I had a client who came to me and said, seduce me. And I was new, I was young. I said, I thought to myself, well, I ran an ad and you answered the ad and you're here. I think I just did seduce you. Mm. But that's not what he meant. You know, he meant actually be the one to initiate sex and initiate foreplay. And unfortunately, I think a lot of women think foreplay is a blowjob. And so it's like there's so many points, you know, the neck, the earlobes, the nipples, the insides of the thighs. There's so many other erogenous zones on a man's body that could be pulled into that that erotic dance. And it doesn't happen a lot of times. And again, I think this is the early training that we get not to be a slut, right?
Sure. Like, and then the other culprit is pornography. I think I say to my clients, stop trying to imitate what you see in pornography, you know, the rushed mechanical sex that's entirely focused on the genitals. And I say, instead, cultivate the opposite of porn, and that would be leisurely, playful, creative, whole body, massage-based lovemaking that includes the genitals, but is not obsessed with them. So, and, you know, I see a lot of young men in their late 20s and 30s who've been watching porn since they were teenagers, and it is a really bad sex education for them, because many women find it impossible to become sexually aroused with only the limited, largely genital touch that a lot of men provide. I mean, women need more. And you started to talk about that. Maybe you can expand on it a little bit more, that women need more.
Well, actually, I was talking about men needing more. I was talking
men
about
men needing more. Yes,
I was talking about women initiating foreplay on men's bodies, mm-hmm. and in other words, arousing a man's earlobes and a man's neck and a man's nipples and the inside of a man's thighs. The places that we usually associate with the kind of foreplay that we would want to initiate on a woman can work just as well with a man. And it that changes the dynamic, the sexual dynamic. If a man is approaching sex very much like he may do the rest of his life, which was kind of a performance thing where he has to perform,
mm-hmm.
Then, you know, he's more likely to try to kind of impress his female partner in ways that doesn't impress her at all, ironically enough.
Mm-hmm.
So he may, you know, get a lot of chi up that ends up leading towards even premature ejaculation.
Exactly.
And I think with women initiating sex and him laying back and kind of being the recipient, in the beginning at least, but this is a way to slow it down and to eroticize
mm-hmm.
it.
Mm-hmm.
And, yeah, and do women need more foreplay? They absolutely do. One of the things I, you know, as a sexologist, when I'm working with clients,
mm-hmm.
I ask them, I say, you probably think if the vagina is lubricated, if it's wet, then it's ready. And everybody usually nods their heads, yes, yes. And I go, wrong.
Mm-hmm.
Because
mm-hmm.
the vulva should be swollen. You know, you've got all kinds of clitoral tissue that needs to be engorged before you would even entertain the idea of penetration. And
that's why I always say the woman needs to be the one to signal when she's ready for penetration. And physiologically, above the cervix is the uterus, and that has, when a woman is fully aroused, and that's usually 15 to 20 minutes, that cervix has to lift up and away. Otherwise, during intercourse, the man's penis can hit the cervix and then the uterus, and that's uncomfortable for most women.
Not for me. I love it.
Okay, right. But for a lot of women, it's uncomfortable. So that uterus needs to lift up and away.
Yeah. One of the things that's happening when it's lifting up and away is that it's actually dipping. So it starts to do a dance. It's attached to all kinds of ligaments. So it's actually, especially at the moment of orgasm, it's going to be dipping down into that little hollow where if you're having unprotected sex with a man, then there would probably be ejaculate in there. So it actually increases your chances of getting pregnant.
Right.
But you want to have all the equipment in engorged and engaged. And, you know, they recently did an ultrasound on the clitoral complex and found that we have literally got these, not just the legs that run under the labia, but we've also got this cuff that runs around the barrel or the shaft of the vagina, so that when the clitoris becomes engorged, it actually tugs around the vagina, and the vagina starts to hug whatever's penetrated it. And we are just constructed for so much sexual pleasure. I'm talking about
we haven't even touched on the vestibular bulbs that are under the labia that are attached to the clitoral system. And those vestibular bulbs need to be filled up with either light munching by the guy or touching the outer labia.
Yeah.
And that contributes a lot to female arousal.
Well, that's the part that I'm trying to admonish my clients to make sure that part gets puffy. And I usually show them some things they can actually do with their hands to stimulate the vestibular bulbs so that that area will start to get puffy.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
It's really sad that, you know, you mentioned porn, and I just wanted to say something about there is a porn star by the name of Jessica Drake, who was just, she did a lot of mainstream porn, and she got really just shocked and concerned when some of her female fans were asking her how they could do what they saw her do in the videos. And she said, well, you can't do it that way. It's a movie. It's fake.
Yeah,
She designed her own line of educational videos. And I'm looking at one of them right now. It's called Jessica Drake's Guide to Wicked Sex. And what I like about, I'm referring some of my clients to get some of her videos. She's got them on Kama Sutra and anal sex and oral sex and all different kinds of topics. But she uses real couples, and the people are they talk a lot about what the sex is like and what they prefer before they actually engage in sex. And none of it's for the benefit of a fantasy or a movie. It's really meant to be educational. And there's one other line of pornography that I want to recommend to your listeners, and that's Comstock. Comstock videos, they also do real couples. And not quite as oriented towards the educational aspects of it as Jessica Drake's videos are, but just really soulful and hot and erotic. And I actually gave this to as a homework assignment to one of my clients who had problems with sex addiction. And I said, I want you to watch one of these Comstock videos and, try masturbating to this. And he told me, I can't. It makes me cry, because there's a lot of feeling in it. These people actually care about each other.
Right, right. And you know who else has a great line of sex education videos is Nina Hartley.
Yes,
and
she does.
She's now in her 50s and still performing. You know, she's a favorite MILF. And she is actually a friend of mine. I know her. She's a really intelligent woman. You know, she's got her RN. She's a nurse, was a nurse. So she's real familiar with all the physical things that are necessary.
I'm a huge fan of Nina Hartley. She and I met in 1990 in the back of a limo headed to do the Montel Williams show.
Oh, good.
So
you know Nina. She's an amazing woman. She is. And she probably, her sex ed videos are really instructive. And I have narrated.
It's so cute because she will like be going down on a girl showing you how to perform.
Right.
Cunnilingus. And then she'll look back at the camera with those big eyes of hers and just smile and wink at you.
That's right. That's how she does it.
Yeah.
But, there would be some discussion. Oh, I started to say I've done a number of sex education videos for the Sinclair Institute where I narrate. Like the most recent ones were a couple's Great Sex for a Lifetime.
And
that focuses, and these videos can be obtained through bettersex.com. But Great Sex for a Lifetime focuses on baby boomers. And we have real couples demonstrating what myself and Dr. Lori Buckley are describing. We're the talking heads, the sex therapists, right? So, and we can learn a lot visually. About 20 years ago, I also narrated a couple's guide to great sex over 40. So, and that's has sold very well. It's still available.
That's great.
Yeah. So
there was something I really wanted to make sure we got a chance to talk about,
yes,
Dave,
please.
If you're okay with it. I learned some things about men that men don't know about men, and I'd love to share that with you and your listeners.
Yes. What is it? I mean, that's really important. What is it that men don't know about men?
Well, they don't know about it, other men, and they also sometimes don't know it about themselves. But let's first talk about what men don't know about other men. There can be kind of this mythology that men mm-hmm. have bought into that somehow or another all the other men on the planet are performing like porn stars sexually. Mm-hmm. So they get it up, they keep it up, and somehow or another they're just a real cocksman.
Mm-hmm.
And then they have problems and their penis tends to be sensitive or shy or moody or mm-hmm. emotional. And it's frustrating to them because they don't think other men are like that.
Right.
And in my experience, all men are like that. All men have mm-hmm. are hardwired so that their hearts and their heads are directly connected to their penis. You know, we've got a lot of jokes about how the penis has got a mind of its own, and that's not really the case. Because men have this mythology about other men, they sometimes look at themselves as being somehow or another deficient or defective. Mm-hmm. And I really want to share with men that, no, I mean, you are so normal. This is all men have difficulty at one time or another. And in particular, when it's out of the context of something that's familiar and loving. So, mm-hmm. To have these expectations that everybody else is having this fabulous time having sex with strangers is probably more of a fantasy than a reality.
The
truth is that if they are really enjoying sex with strangers, they probably have learned to do so in a way that is still centered in their heart or connected to their emotions.
Mm-hmm.
And when you try to separate those two and have sex that has no emotional content, it's just not going to work. And it's certainly not going to work long term.
It won't work long term.
Yeah. And you can some people unfortunately will try to, the emotion they'll try to tap into is anger. And again, that's going to burn out pretty quickly and, of course, burn a lot of bridges too.
So you're an anger specialist. Can you expand on the anger piece of it?
Yeah, if the only emotion that men are allowed to show publicly, to admit to, is being angry, then they kind of, they bring that, sometimes they may bring that into their talk with each other around sex. So the way that men will talk with each other around sex is they're fronting. They're trying to act like they are a lot tougher than they really are. And, yeah, man, I really put it to her or whatever. That kind of talk has very little to do with what happens behind closed doors. So, like, a woman's experience of a man a lot of times that she gets to meet his little inner child who's very vulnerable. Then he goes back out and talks to his friends as if he's a real tough guy and a real badass.
Yes.
And men will particularly do that around sex. So I just, you know, it's painful to me that there's this this story that goes on and kind of perpetuates a hostile relationship between the genders, too. And I think, you know, instead it's not okay to be sentimental and sweet and sensitive and vulnerable. And I remember this one client, he had come to see me for his 50th birthday. And nothing was working for him at all. And the only thing that could get him aroused was my talking about his wife. And I remember telling him, it's okay to be in love with your wife. Mm. Go home. Go home to your wife. And the only reason he was there is because she had given him permission.
Oh, good woman. Open woman, I'd say.
Turns out it was not a gift he wanted.
Oh.
So when we're talking about the relationship between men and women, I'd like to encourage men to understand that they and the guys that are busy bragging and saying a bunch of stuff that's not even true are far more vulnerable and sensitive and emotional than they give themselves credit for. And the women who are in relationship with those men, I would love to see them make room for that, not be afraid of it. Mm-hmm. You know, sometimes women can kind of put a lot of pressure on the men in their lives to be strong and impervious to pain and somehow or another don't cry. I've heard this a lot, you know, like she doesn't want to see my weak or tender side. And that's really sad to me because, you know, we are first and foremost human beings.
Well, and a sign of a true emotional intimacy is the ability to be vulnerable to trust. And so these things may need to be developed. There regarding this, there was a study done at MIT, and they were the axiom that they were looking at is that since women are the undisputed emotional champions of any relationship, women are supposed to profess their love first. But in this research, they found it was dead wrong. Their surveys of 20 and 30-somethings revealed that men say, I love you first, 60 to 70% of the time. They even thought about saying it a full 6 weeks before their mate did. Then some of the men who answered this, who were in short-term relationships, actually regretted saying it because I love you after sex Well, they began to realize what they'd done, that they said that in order to get laid. But men of long-term persuasion were as happy to hear the words after sex as women were when they said, mm-hmm. I love you.
Mm-hmm.
Doesn't that resonate for you even?
Well, it makes me sad, actually, that we're having to do research on the fact that men are human beings who, you know, my God, if you've ever held a baby boy in your arms.
And I've done that. My son is now 36, but I've done that. He's such a wonderful boy.
They're sweet. They're innocent. They have just as many needs as little girls do.
Yeah.
And it's really, 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 really sad that we try to program that out of them and make them into quote-unquote men. I always thought it was kind of a weird thing because if being a man is natural and how mm-hmm. it's supposed to be, why mm-hmm. do we have to be afraid that people won't be men? If they're born men, just let them grow up the way they are. They'll be the kind of men they're supposed to be.
Mm-hmm.
And instead, it seems like we have this histrionics around, oh, no, you know, he's not going to be masculine enough. And I'm like, wow, well, you know, maybe if your standard of masculinity is that artificial that you have to mandate it, maybe it's not really natural after all. Maybe that's not even how we're built.
I think maybe it's not. Oh, there's the music.
Oh,
right.
My
Veronica,
God, that went by so fast.
I know. So, Veronica, I'm going to have you back early in 2017.
All right.
I'll be in touch with you about that. Thank you so much.
All right. Bye-bye.
Bye. My boy, get it.